From the News Centre at 5, Chris Hoon has become the third Cabinet Minister to resign from the coalition government. The former Energy Secretary and his ex-wife are being charged with perverting the course of justice over alleged speeding offences. His Lib Dem party leader Nick Clegg gave him his backing, saying he would welcome him back to government if he cleared his name. Mr Hoon says he's innocent.
I intend to fight this in the courts, and I'm confident that a jury will agree. So as to avoid any distraction, I am standing down and resigning as Energy and Climate Change Secretary. I will, of course, continue to serve my constituents in Eastleigh.
John Terry has once again been stripped of the England captaincy. The Football Association says he won't lead the team until allegations against him are resolved. His trial on racial abuse charges takes place after Euro 2012. Terry denies the allegations against him. Luther Blissett was one of the first black players to represent England and says the situation should have been sorted by now.
I think they really should have had the trial by now, so we all exactly would have known exactly where we stand. You know, he would know. You know, the fact that they stripped him from it, I think, is right. For the fact that, you know, it's now we can stop talking about this leading up to the Euros, which is a very important time for England.
The FBI has confirmed that hackers have intercepted a conference call between American investigators and their counterparts at Scotland Yard. Hacking group Anonymous says it was behind the release of the confidential conversation. David Cameron's travelling to the US next month. President Obama and the Prime Minister will discuss the forming NATO and G8 summits, as well as developments in Afghanistan and the Middle East. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station run almost entirely by volunteers and is here to give the community of Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative spokesman for Sports and Leisure and councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Alistair Watson. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, environmental groups unite to brighten up Bristol city centre, and the government declares the southwest of England a marine park. Is there any substance to the words? Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth is here. And as housing benefit and social security come under the coalition chopping block, Will Stone's here from Avon and Bristol Law Centre to explain your rights. French A Hospital, with a world-beating reputation, is set to close, but the new Southmead Hospital is being built under PFI at the same time. And as North Bristol NHS Trust goes foundation status, is this all too much change at the same time when there's talk of NHS privatisation? So we get the lowdown from North Bristol NHS Trust's outgoing Chief Executive Ruth Brunt. Plus, was Richard Branson right to call for the decriminalisation of drugs? Is there really such a massive gulf between heroin and alcohol? And we take an expert opinion on what the big drug dealers and organised criminals fear the most. Danny Kushlick from Bristol-based national drug charity Transform is here. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Oh, quite proud that last Friday we predicted snow for this weekend. Tonight, lows of minus 5 degrees Celsius. Beautiful skies, but dry. This weekend, highs of 3 degrees Celsius, some sunny spells and a chance of light snow Saturday afternoon. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius, warmer and wetter in the middle of the week, sunnier and colder the other days. Next weekend, 11th and 12th of February, highs of minus 2 again, so back down to freezing again next weekend, but sunny also. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Conservative spokesman for Sports and Leisure, also councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Alistair Watson. Hi, Alistair. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Just want to correct you there. I am not the spokesman for Sports and Leisure. I'm the spokesman for Children's Services, actually.
OK, has that changed recently or what?
No. I've never done Sports and Leisure, so I don't know where that's come from.
Well, it came from your office about the Conservative office at the City Council about 3 weeks ago, so maybe I'd better inform them as well. Your background, tell us how you came into politics. What's your professional background?
My professional background is a businessman. I've been in business management, consultancy, training, and started up my own businesses and over the past. And I've just had an interest in politics ever since I was at university, actually, and eventually sort of move forward. And I've also, you know, I've been a candidate for parliamentary seats, but now become a city councillor.
But I mean, with management consultants, what we want to really know is what kind of business do you actually have experience of? What kind of business is it itself that you've sort of cut your teeth on?
I did a lot with private sector, but the last 5 years have been mainly in local government, actually, particularly in London, Southwark Council, Haringey, Kensington, Chelsea, done a lot of work in those councils.
So what does a management consultant do?
Well, yes, we borrow your watch to tell you the time. That's what we're supposed to be doing. We go in and we try and help and try and make things more efficient, more effective. A lot of the things that local government have been doing has been splitting their back office and front office. We've been trying to help organisations with their back office systems, organising their processes so that they become more efficient, serving the customer better and doing that in a way that can be affordable.
But does that mean quite often privatising, sacking people?
Well, I haven't been involved in any of that. No, I don't. I mean, sometimes, yeah, outside companies do come in. People don't get sacked. Mainly, they get toopied over from one organisation to another. Some people aren't happy with that process, but it works sometimes. Doesn't work so well in other times. It depends on how good the management are.
Isn't that your job though, as a consultant, to make sure the management are doing their job properly?
Well, we don't making them do that job properly, but we do help. And I think management consultancy does have a role. I know that it can be a profession that people think that we're just sort of making money out of the fault of others, but I think there is a role for somebody to come in and shine a light on things or put a mirror up to what's going on.
Now we've got some big changes, at least on the cards this year. The elected mayor and elected police commissioner. This is essentially a kind of US system of local government. What are your thoughts about first of all whether you think it is a US type system, and also whether you're in favour of the police commissioner and the mayor being elected?
Yeah, I think it is inspired by what's happened in the States and perhaps also some of the countries like Sweden and maybe even New Zealand, places like that. I think the Conservative Party, when they were in opposition, did a lot of thinking about this, and I got involved very early on, years ago, on the localism agenda, looking at what can be done to reinvigorate local politics. I think there's arguments for and against a local mayor. I'm actually, on balance, I think it'll be a good thing. And mainly because it'll, people will see who's in charge. I hope that it will, get people talking about politics. That person will be seen more. There'll be a face of local politics in Bristol. So I'm hoping good things with the elected mayor.
What about the police commissioner? Because certainly most of the people I've spoken to who are on the existing police authority think that there's actually quite a non-political agenda going on there, because you've got people from all different political parties. You've got some from the city, some from the countryside, with just one commissioner. Isn't that liable to politicise the police?
I can't see it. I think we're more sensible in this country than sort of politicising that role. I think it's a good idea that it is elected. I mean, at the moment, we have a lot of people on these police boards, and they're local councillors or unelected. They haven't been elected to those positions; they've been chosen. So, to actually have an election, I think it will sort of help to get a number of people more involved in it, and I think the jury's out a bit on that one. I have to say it's not one that I'd be peddling as much as the elected mayor, but I think there's a lot of scare tactics going on. I don't think it's going to be as bad as people might think.
Now, the Conservative group here in Bristol is not in power, but you are up at Westminster, most certainly. What's the relationship between Conservatives up at Westminster and in our... certainly up until 1900, this was Britain's second city.
Indeed, yes, yeah. And I think that we do see a lot of politicians coming out here.
I suppose I should say England's second city, really.
Yes, careful.
So what's the relationship like between the Conservatives in Bristol and those at Westminster?
It is close. We have our MPs. We now have a couple of MPs in Bristol. The leader of our group does keep in touch with central office and we should call it CCHQ these days. But there is a still close relationship there. And things like elected mayors and so on, which is central government policy. We get talked to and persuaded to toe the line, I guess.
But around the streets of Bristol, a lot of the cabinet are seen as sort of thuggish, bullying club millionaire toffs, and they're stealing from the rich. Stealing from the poor to give to the rich.
I don't think so. I think that's perhaps one or two people that you might have talked to, but they're not the type that I talk to. In my ward of Westbury-on-Trim, I think they see the Conservatives are doing some really good things and moving things forward.
But what about the National Health Service? Because that's a bit of a sacred cow in a way, and there was no talk about reforming that before the election. So in a way, there's the whole sort of goalposts have shifted, haven't they, since the general election?
Yeah, I think people say that there wasn't any talk of it. I think there was talk. There was talk of changing the PCTs and the Strategic Health Authorities. I think there certainly was. You don't come into power and just leave things as they were. But I think the National Health Service is going to be there. The Conservatives want to see it there as much as any other party. Perhaps the way it's delivered might change a little bit over time.
Isn't there something fundamentally wrong, though? Because we keep hearing talk about getting people into jobs, getting more people off benefits and into jobs, but there aren't enough jobs to go around as it is. In fact, the number of jobs is going down.
Well, I don't know if the number of jobs are going down.
Unemployment has just gone up 120,000.
Yeah, but there is immigration and all the rest of it, and there's a balancing thing. But manufacturing is doing well. If you noticed the latest figures there, it's going up. We're in tough times. We're in tough world economic difficulty. And actually our economy is not doing that badly. I think the real difficulty are the younger people and their job opportunities at the moment, and I think we do need to work on that one, and we will need to do more work on that one. I'm hoping George Osborne will look at how we can stimulate that better over the next year or two and bring those younger people, the ones leaving colleges and universities, and get them into work as soon as possible.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Bang to rights this week, Martin. 9 British Islamists pleaded guilty to the new offence of preparing for acts of terror. 4 of them planning to bomb the Stock Exchange, we're told, and taking photos of the House of Commons too. So what are your thoughts about the news this week that there does seem to be... this is a bit of a victory for MI5.
Well, I haven't looked at this case closely, I have to say. I have heard about it. I haven't looked into it closely, so I don't want to comment too... with too much certainty about it one way or the other, but I mean there was a jury, they were convicted. The question has to be,
well, there wasn't a trial, this is because they pleaded
guilty.
Well,
there wasn't a trial because they pleaded guilty, and one wonders what kind of pressures were exerted for that to happen. Perhaps it would have been better if there had been a trial and we'd been able to see the evidence properly. Of course, there are still questions about the relationship between Islamist groups and Western intelligence services going back 20 or 30 years. And in this context, I'm thinking particularly of Haroon Rashid Aswat, named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind of 7/7, and then disappeared into preventive detention when sources in the United States government named him as an MI6 double agent. Now, these are all very, very complicated questions and very complicated cases, so I don't want to actually comment on the individual case that you've mentioned without looking into it more closely.
Acts preparatory to terrorism includes things like taking pictures of the, in this case, of the House of Commons, writing down something about the Stock Exchange, which may be the Stock Exchange and it may not. But this has moved the goalposts a little bit, hasn't it? So they're not actually, nobody was actually buying any kind of materials for a bomb. This is acts preparatory to terrorism. Yeah, are you a bit concerned about this? Because I'm not sure.
The significance, of course, is that they pleaded guilty. Secondly, of course, the question is, who is ultimately behind these jihadi groups? And this is a question being asked all over the world. And we know for a fact that MI6 were the lead agency in Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. Many jihadi groups were based in London at that time working with MI6. And we need to go back to look back over that period if we want to get to the bottom of what's going on.
You're talking about Finsbury Park Mosque there, aren't you?
That's one of the factors. Yes, that was heavily infiltrated by Western Intelligence Services. Anyway, these are bigger questions. We had our own Bristol bomber, if you remember, who was a loner who went to private school in the north of the city, decided he was a skateboarder, decided he was a rap star, then decided he was an Islamist terrorist, and of course he was handed in by the Muslim community in the city, who said this man's dangerous.
That's actually the case for these nine guys as well, because they were actually reported to the police by their own mosques and told that they weren't allowed to come.
I think
to
that
mosque.
Is the good news for people listening to this, is that in the mosque, certainly in Bristol, they're very aware of the dangers, and people who look as if they're off the rails are identified quickly.
Alistair, what's your thoughts about this this case, particularly this week? We've seen it's almost as if there's this thing bubbling under the surface the whole time. We're never quite sure if the security services and the police are going to be able to keep a handle on it, because certainly the allegation in this case was that these chaps had been planning to possibly attack the House of Commons, even though they actually only had a photograph of the House of Commons, and also the Stock Exchange too.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult to know when you can prosecute somebody. You know, I guess, you know, it's like thought crime, isn't it? You know, if you suddenly start to think about something, you know, should you be banged up in prison? And, you know, do you go on the internet, and if you have a look at some of the, you know, perhaps how to make a bomb, is that, you know? So it's very difficult to know when the authorities can step in. I mean, they were obviously keeping this group under very close surveillance, from what I could see in the reports. And I like the description that they're using at the moment, that, you know, a few years ago it was like, you know, it was like a football match, and they were clearing things off the line just about or making sure there weren't any huge atrocities after the, of course, the 7/7 ones. But now there's a feeling they've got sort of like an offside trap. They can pick these people up just before they have a go. So, I mean, you know, we have to do this sort of stuff. It's a shame we have to. These are British born and they're British citizens, and you know, we've got to stop this.
How concerned are you, though, about this whole thing of plea bargaining? I know we don't call it over here, but the idea is maybe even just simply the day before the trial,
I know,
you know, someone will go in to say, look, you know, you stand to go down for 25 years, but if you were to plead guilty, it'll only be maybe 15 years. Now, what do you think about that in just in terms of justice? Is that just?
It surprised me, actually, to be honest, because it did seem like plea bargaining. And when you think these guys have spent a couple of years in prison, they've got a 15-year sentence, so, you know, in about 5 or 6 years they'll be out again, you know, after they've served half of it. So it does rather seem that way. You know, it certainly tells you that they were not innocent of any crimes, but on the other hand, you know, should we be allowing it? I don't know. It's very difficult.
Martin, do you think there's an element of bamboozling at the last minute here, that maybe it would be better if the whole thing had come to trial and all the evidence had come out?
I would have preferred, if we want to be confident that justice is done and being seen to be done, and also for other people in the community to see that justice is done. If it goes before a jury and they're convicted, then there can't be any arguments about it. But there may be some people thinking that something has gone on behind closed doors here. That's the danger of it.
Well, we've heard all about massive increases in electricity prices and gas prices. This week, it's the turn of the water industry to put their prices up. And a piece in The Guardian this week. I know Alistair is not his favourite paper. But anyway, this is from Neil Clark. Here we go again. In the past 12 months, we've had significant hikes in gas and electricity, not reversed by recent cuts due to a fall in wholesale prices and above inflation increases in train fares, which are already the highest in Europe. Now it's time for the water companies to put the boot in. Ofwat's announced that average household water and sewage bills in England and Wales are to increase by an average of 5.7% from April. Now, it was privatised under a Conservative government, not necessarily yours, Alistair, but what are your thoughts about this rather bold call by Neil Clark in The Guardian to renationalise the water?
It gives a good headline. I don't think there's any chance of it ever happening. whether it should have been privatised in the first place could be a discussion point. I'm sure Martin has an opinion on that one. And I think actually quite a lot of Conservative voters would sort of wonder about whether this was a particularly, you know, was it the privatisation too far, particularly when you see overseas companies now owning some of our water companies and delivering our water. It's one of those things that I think that the water companies are doing a good job. I think that they are well regulated, and I think there's an enormous need for good regulation. I think they're doing it responsibly. It does cost money to put in the pipes, and there are costs that they have to recover. So,
but does it matter if, say, a French company owns our water if they're delivering it cheaply and it's not good fresh water?
I've got no problem with that. I mean, it's not as though they can take the pipes away and take them back to France with them, can they? You know, so even if we had a war against France, which I'm sure we wouldn't have, but you know, I'm sure we'd still be able to get our water to people. So I don't think it's the foreign ownership that's the problem. I think there may be a principle of whether it should be owned by the government as a debating point. Whether that's a British company or a French company, I don't think matters.
Martin, prices of water going up 5.7% from April, and actually in Wales, places as much as 8.2%. Is it time to renationalise?
Well, as the article points out, I mean, in Scotland and Wales, they still have national water companies. I think the case for having either severe regulation, as suggested by Alistair, or nationalisation of these industries is quite strong, because there isn't really a competitive structure. When somebody bids for the contract, they promise various things which they may or may not deliver, and once they've got the contract, they can do what they like.
Yeah, but if they can do that for the gas pipes and the electricity wires, I mean, there's not like five sets of electricity wires coming into your house. Why can't they do it for water too?
Well, can't they do what? I mean,
have a competitive market.
No, yeah. But it isn't competitive, and that's the problem. It's an oligopoly, and oligopolies have collusive pricing structures, and that's the nature of it. And this is why these industries were nationalised in the first place. I mean, Birmingham's water originally was set up as a system by Joseph Chamberlain in the 1890s, who was the elected mayor, if you like, of Birmingham at the time, and they created reservoirs in Wales, and they created a whole structure for Birmingham, and that was then nationalised and then privatised. So, but in actual fact, you could make a case that it didn't belong to the National Water Authority. It had been set up by the City of Birmingham in the first place, subsumed under nationalisation, and then privatised. So, I mean, other parts of the world, these industries are run by the people, for the people, and that's the standard practice in Scandinavia and so on.
Now, I'm looking at Alistair. I know what he's thinking. Martin, if they were to renationalise it, where would the money come from?
Well, I mean, the question is, what priorities have you got? I mean, say there was a Labour government, for example, and they had an aspiration to renationalise water, it probably would be down the list of things to do, because they'd have to do other things first. The question, as Alistair said, is should it be in public ownership in the first place, and that's open to debate.
But, I mean, if you're going to renationalise anything, you've got to pay for it, haven't you? You've got to buy it off the people that own it now.
The easiest thing to renationalise is things that are bankrupt. So Network Rail had to be taken over by the government because it had fallen apart.
And what about the banks?
Well, indeed, that's exactly what happened, isn't it? I mean, we had to spend money on them because they'd messed up.
I think that the other side of it is that you know, we can look at sort of public ownership of some of these things, but public ownership, and it we look back with rose-tinted glasses. I mean, you know, a lot of these, you know, when you look at the train company when it was nationalised, and even the water company, you know, that it's at the whim of politicians then about how much money they get. The people that work within the organisation become complacent because they've got a job for life, or they see it like that. So, you know, nationalised companies are not, you know, they're not the panacea for all ills that we have in society.
But the problem with these basic industries, like things like the railways, the water, etc., is when they're privatised, then what happens is you get people taking massive profits out of them. I mean, we've had this thing recently, for example, up at Temple Meads, with all the taxi drivers being told, because legally we can do it, we're going to charge every single taxi driver, at the moment, something like £400 a year, and in future years, going up to something like £2,000 a year, just to simply ply for trade. And when they're in that situation, they have they're in a very, very powerful position. Surely the government has a duty to be in there, making sure it's acting fairly, not simply doing what it wants.
And I think you're right, Nathan. I think that's why, you know, the argument for good regulation, I think that's one of the problems with the banks, was the absolute abysmal regulation that was over a number of years, and through every political party that was
Well, I'm pointing the finger at Martin now, because actually it was under Labour, of course, that power to set interest rates, for example, was taken away and given to the Bank of England. And there was a massive deregulation under New Labour, the 13 years of the Labour government. And in fact, many people would quite rightly say, well, that's when all this, all the disasters in the financial sector were allowed to brew up.
Well, I think, as Alistair pointed out earlier, it's actually there's been a generation of taking our eye off the ball in the financial sector, and both political parties actually are responsible for that, largely because the financial sector is terribly powerful politically, not just in the Conservative Party. I mean, David Miliband was writing in the New Statesman this week saying that the leadership of the Labour Party were going to frighten business if they carried on talking the way they were talking, and so on. Everybody is running scared of them, even though we are propping them up. Although we saw a crack in that this week with Heston losing his bonus and Sir Fred Goodwin being denighted and so on. But I think there's been a generation of failure to understand the dangers in financial markets from all sides.
Where would you lay the blame for the financial crisis, Alistair?
I think the banks are certainly culpable for quite a bit of it.
Because we're still seeing if you talk to any small businessman, they will tell you, or business person, they will tell you that they're still not lending. One of the things we had in a Treasury Select Committee a few weeks ago was the figures that for every £1 billion that goes in bonuses, that is something like 20 to 100 billion less that they can lend out. So they're dishing themselves out bonuses, really oblivious to the fact that means that they can't lend out to small businesses.
Well, I was speaking to some bankers just recently, and they are desperate to actually lend to small businesses. That what they're saying is the small business is not coming forward and asking for loans, and maybe it's because, you know, they're frightened to leverage themselves too highly at the moment.
But I think a lot of small business people would disagree with that. So where were you meeting with these bankers? Where can the small business people go and find these bankers to twist their arm?
If I say you're just going to, it was at the Institute of Directors I was meeting with these people. But there's Lloyd's TSB. They certainly would like to lend if they can find the right businesses to lend to. I think some businesses are finding it difficult because they're in a difficult trading position. And banks are like that. They're not into risk. It's not risk capital that they're offering to businesses. So, you know, the business does have to have some collateral behind it before they're going to lend to them.
OK, well, let's go down to the House of Commons on Wednesday this week and have a listen to Prime Minister's Questions, where Ed Miliband took David Cameron, hauled him over the coals over the whole business of top pay disclosure. That is to say, how we know how much these bankers mainly are getting.
Last Labour government, when he was in the cabinet, that agreed an RBS bonus pool of £1.3 billion. Literally hundreds of people were getting £1 million bonuses, and he signed it off. The issue for the honourable gentleman is, why is he in favour now in opposition of things he never did in government? Some might call it opposition, some people might call it hypocrisy.
Ed Miliband.
Mr Speaker, I'll tell him what hypocrisy is. It's saying he's going to stop a £1 million bonus to Stephen Hester and then nodding it through. And I have to say to him, I think we've now heard it all, because he says that the class war against the bankers is going to be led by him and his cabinet of millionaires. I don't think it's going to wash, frankly. Now, let me ask him... Now let me ask him about another simple proposal. He had no answer on transparency. Does he agree with me that to bring a dose of realism to the decisions about top pay, there should be an ordinary employee on every pay committee, so that people on a huge salary at least have to look one of their employees in the eye and justify it?
Order. The Prime Minister will know that the use of the word hypocrisy in relation to an individual member is not parliamentary. Therefore, just before... Order! Just before the Prime Minister begins his reply, I would ask him to withdraw that term straight away.
I'm very happy to do that, Mr. Speaker. I think it's just because that we're expected to listen to the people who presided over the biggest banking and financial disaster in our history. And it's not as if they had nothing to do with it. One of them was the City Minister, and the other one was sitting in the Treasury. And I have to ask, who was it who failed to regulate the banks? Yeah. Labour. Who was it who gave us the boom and bust? Labour. Who was it who failed to fix the roof when the sun was shining? Labour. Who presided over these multi-million pound bonuses and did absolutely nothing? Labour. Now, I have looked very carefully at his propositions. I don't think it is practical to do what he is suggesting. It breaks an important principle of not having people on a remuneration committee who have their own pay determined. So I don't think it's the right way forward.
That was an extract from Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday in the House of Commons. I'm joined by Conservative Councillor Alistair Watson. Alistair, he was ticked off there, wasn't he, David Cameron, by the Speaker. But what about the substantive issue there, which is one of the certainly most sensible things Ed Miliband was saying, that the idea of employees, actually at least just one employee, being on the remuneration committee. So at least they can see that those committees are acting fairly. Because one of the things we're worried about is that as companies are going down, as the prospects are not necessarily looking good for the economy, that directors are actually taking quite a lot of money out of these companies before it goes down, sort of almost as the sinking ship goes down.
I don't like to agree with Ed Miliband, but I'd actually think that's a good suggestion, to be honest. I think all of us think that this banker's pay and bonuses is just absolutely stratospheric. I mean, you know, it bears no relation to what normal people earn, you know, in normal occupations. And you know, what I thought was really amusing with the sort of Stephen Hester thing was that they thought that this was really low. This sort of, if they keep it under a million, that's so small and pathetic, you know, that no one would complain about it. And of course, we look at it from the other side and think £1 million, nearly £1 million in just a bonus, is just, you know, what we'd all love to have in our pension pots at the end of our working lives. So it's just a different perspective these bankers have on things, and things have to change there. And I mean, I'm not a dyed-in-the-wood socialist by any sense of it, but I would certainly think that there needs to be some restructuring of how banking works and banking salaries. I think it's a good suggestion. Let's get some workers on the remuneration committees. Absolutely.
Also, I mean, how is David Cameron going to go away from this whole image of being a cabinet of millionaires for millionaires?
I don't think many people worry about it. I don't hear about on the streets. I don't, you know, there's, you know, one or two people talk about George Osborne and his background and so on. But, you know, and I think people just look at how well they're actually performing and what they're doing for the country. And I think most people think they're doing the right things.
Martin, Ed Miliband, employee representation on the remuneration committee, if I can say it right. I want to say remuneration, but it's remuneration, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's been standard practice in Germany since the war, largely because the British occupation authorities in Germany tied the hands of the big industrialists in Germany at the end of the war by insisting that they had workers on their boards, not just on the remuneration committees, but on the board.
But doesn't this so dissent? You know, if you've got someone coming back to the shop floor saying, oh, they've just awarded themselves this amount and this amount.
Yeah, also, on this question of transparency, in Norway, ever since World War II, everybody's tax returns have been public property. So you're able to find out exactly what people earn and exactly how much people are worth. And over time, it's led to much higher taxes on wealthy people in Norway than you would find in
getting back
country.
To Germany, isn't it actually quite divisive to have an employee on the remuneration board? Because they're then going to go snitching back to the shop floor saying, oh, they're awarding themselves this, that and everything else.
That is the whole point. And therefore, the people making the decision realise that that's what will happen. And I mean, in Germany, they've had this kind of tripartite structure of industry. We tried similar things in the 70s and never managed it in this country. But it's bizarre because it was the British who insisted on having this kind of strong worker input into decision making in big companies in Germany as a kind of political thing, really, to punish the big industrialists for supporting Hitler. And it actually worked really well for the Germans. And we're still arguing about it, you know, 70 years later.
Alistair, isn't there something slightly irritating about the fact that you're paying the people who do the least, the directors, who come in maybe one day a week or whatever, and you're paying them 20, 30 times more than the people who are actually cleaning out the toilets and are there at 7 o'clock in the morning?
I think you've got quite the wrong view of what management and directors do. And actually, I mean, it's such a tough job that and they're taking an enormous amount of risk. I mean, the directors...
On the golf club fields?
Well, only when they retire.
In the summer.
I tell you, the directors I know spend an enormous amount of time on their businesses, and they're incredibly committed, and they take a lot of risks, not just with the company's money, but most of them take a big risk when they're starting businesses up with their own money, with their houses, and they deserve some reward for that.
Okay, well, we'll be talking about the National Health Service after the 6 o'clock news, but we're also talking about health now. Hi, Marina.
Hello. Today we will talk about coronary health disease, CHD. CHD is the UK's biggest killer. Around 1 in 5 men and 1 in 7 women die from disease. The term describes what happens when your heart blood supply is blocked, a heart attack, or restricted by a built-up of fatty substances in the coronary arteries. The UK has one of the worst heart attack rates in the world. Someone has a heart attack every 2 minutes in Britain. In the UK, there are 94,000 annual deaths from the CHD, or one every 5.5 minutes. Also, there are an estimated 2.6 million people living with the condition. Angina, the most common symptom of coronary heart disease, affects 2 million people. CHD affects more men than women, and your chances of getting it increase as you get older. Some simple lifestyle changes can reduce your risk of getting coronary heart disease by reducing your blood pressure and cholesterol level. If you already have heart disease, you can take steps to control your condition. Eat a healthy, balanced diet, be more physically active, keep to a healthy weight, give up smoking, reduce your alcohol consumption, keep your blood pressure under control, keep your diabetes under control, and take any medication that is prescribed for you. If you have CHD, you may be prescribed medication to help relieve your symptoms and stop further problems developing. If you do not have CHD, but you have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, or a history of family heart disease, your doctor may prescribe medication to prevent your developing heart-related problems.
Okay, Marina, thanks very much. Now, Alistair Watson, you're a Conservative councillor. I'm sure you're not necessarily an expert on health, but why do you think it is that Britain has got such a high level of coronary heart disease? It's something which is ultimately, to a certain extent anyway, preventable, largely through things like stopping smoking and diet and that kind of thing. Why is our rate so high?
I think that it is because of those lifestyle issues. When you look at, it's not the same across the country, and when you look further south and in some of the shires, you'll find that it's quite low. It's, you know, you head up north, maybe there's a bit more smoking, a few more fish and chip shops, and you get to Scotland and you have haggis and chips for you know, it's a lot of lifestyle stuff. I do a lot of running, and I think we don't do enough sports. We get to a certain age and we tend to sit and watch TV too much or go down the pub.
So will we see you jogging around the streets of Westbury on Trim, or are you down the gym?
No, I'm outside. I'm running the London Marathon this year, actually.
Okay.
And talking about health matters, I'm running it for the BUI, the Bristol Urological Institute. So that's prostate cancer.
Okay, so do you get fellow Westbrion Trimians kind of coming up alongside you and talking about their problems in the area as you're jogging down the road?
They haven't yet. They haven't yet. I tend to run around the downs and I stick my headphones in. So,
okay, Martin, what about you? Why have we got such a high rate of coronary heart disease in Britain?
Well, it is lifestyle, as Alistair points out. In the book, The Spirit Level, which was been very influential on progressive thinking in the last two or three years, it's Wilson Pickett Kate Pickett and Richard Wilson, who are the professors who did it, and what they showed.
Wilson Pickett did the soundtrack.
Wilson Pickett, yes, that's how I remember it.
Wilson Pickett did the soundtrack.
He did the soundtrack to the book. But anyway, what the book points out, and they've got lots of stats in the book, and Marina knows the book because I lent it to her, is that all sorts of social stats, including health stats, are much better in more equal societies. And they come up with reasons for that, but I mean the stats they present are pretty overwhelming, and it doesn't really seem to matter how objectively wealthy a society is. You can be a poor society which is more equal and you will have good stats, and you can be a rich society which is more equal and you will have good stats on health and social things like that, suicide, alcoholism, and so on. And they've started an institute to push this as a general, you know, as a kind of a piece of information for all political parties and for everybody to look at. I mean, in a competitive capitalist society like Japan, they have a more equal. They don't have a welfare system, but they have internal. You know, the gap between the people at the top and the people at the bottom is deliberately kept low, and I think that it's not so much how you get the equality, but if you get a kind of more equal society, you do actually get better stats on health as well. And of course, we might disagree about how you might get a more equal society, but it's not a question of more welfare, as it were. You could have a more equal society. I mean, in Japan, they don't have state pensions and so on and so forth, but what they have is lifetime employment and things of that sort. So that's how they get the result.
Well, we seem a million miles away from that over here, this whole lifetime employment thing, what with another 120,000 people in the last 3 months on the dole. But anyway, on to another story, and this is from Gloucestershire. The police threatening a vote of no confidence if a ruling to freeze the precept tax is passed. This is actually from the Stroud News and Journal. Officers on the beat in Gloucestershire have warned they'll pass an unprecedented vote of no confidence in the police authority if a ruling is made not to increase the force's tax precept. The action will be the first of its kind ever undertaken by serving officers in Britain, and comes ahead of a public meeting to set the constabulary's budget on the 9th of February. Senior chiefs have already expressed deep concern at the authority's proposal to scrap a call for a 3% precept rise, an annual increase in less than £6 per year. Officers say we'll pile an extra £1.3 million savings on top of existing annual cuts of £24 million. Now, Martin, is pretty worrying, isn't it? I mean, there seems to be a bit of disquiet in the ranks up in Gloucestershire.
Well, I mean, at times when things are being cut, whether it's police, NHS, education, obviously those who do the job tend to see what the problems are going to be if they have to manage with less money, and the police are there fighting their corner saying, look, we can barely manage with what we've got, and we need the resources to do the job properly. The government will have to decide how they're going to cope with that.
Alistair Watson, it's not often that you see the Police Federation lining up with the Chief Constable, who's actually, this is last week, he was saying that the Gloucestershire force is teetering on the brink if they have to go through with all these cuts.
I know, it's very worrying, and as a Conservative, we've always prided ourselves on looking after the police and putting more bobbies on the beat, and you know, this has been what we've always wanted to do, and it's in these tough times, and we're asking for cuts everywhere.
I mean, this is great for the criminals, isn't it?
Well, it may be.
Aren't they laughing when they see that the police are saying, we're not going to be able to do our job if this happens?
If frontline staff are being cut. I mean, I think that there are some backroom staff that may be dispensable, but I think that if frontline policing is having to be cut, if we have less policemen out there, then yeah, the criminals will have a better time of it. So
and this was also brought up by the MP Paul Farrelly at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Paul Farrelly, Can I associate myself and the whole House with the Prime Minister's remarks and condolences to the family and friends of the two brave soldiers who've given the ultimate sacrifice in the service of their country? Mr. Speaker, in the past week, chief constables in England and Wales have warned that policing is on a cliff edge and facing a watershed moment as numbers fall to the lowest in a decade. My own force in Staffordshire is cutting hundreds of officers and staff. Yet during the TV debates at the general election, the Prime Minister said the following. There's no doubt about it. We're not seeing enough police on the streets. We're not catching enough burglars. We're not convicting enough. So could I ask the Prime Minister, how does his rhetoric then square with the reality of what's happening to frontline policing now?
Well, the fact is the percentage of officers on the front line has actually increased. We inherited a situation where there were 6,000 uniformed officers performing back office roles in the police. Now, we have had to make difficult spending reductions, but I think if he listens to his front bench, he'll now find out they support the cuts, and they support the pay freeze, and they even so strongly support our police commissioners that droves of Labour MPs are going to quit to try and become them.
Well, that was Paul Farrelly and David Cameron replying to his question about policing. Yeah, it seems a sort of rising disquiet that this is something that the Labour government would never have been able to get away with.
I think there's got to be a limit to what the Conservative government will get away with, because we do need police on our streets. It's a fundamental right that we can have a safe environment in our communities. And I think if we do start to see reductions in police numbers, that the ones that are out there on the streets, I think there will be, even grassroots Conservatives will be making some noises about this one.
Martin, it's not often that you see the Police Federation lining up with the ACPO and the Association of Chief Constables, is it?
No, and I think when David Cameron had a go at the police after the riots in August, he didn't please the police very much at all. And it was an open goal for the Labour front bench to line up with the police to say that he'd got it wrong. I think the real problem, which was just touched on in the clip, is the cuts themselves. I don't believe, and I know that the Labour front bench have been very wobbly on this in the last month, I don't believe we should be cutting public expenditure at all at this moment. It's actually a foolish manoeuvre. And we're going to see the results of that as we go into this year, and we lose our credit rating and the deficit increases. At that point, I think there's going to be serious questions about
the policy.
Well,
I think there will be questions over our credit rating if we started spending hand over fist now.
No, but if we'd carried on doing what we were doing, you could have had a Conservative Liberal coalition which would have carried on pretty much the same fiscal policy, and that's I think what the electorate thought they were voting for: a change of the team, but we want a steady as she goes policy. Attempts to cut public expenditure failed in Greece, failed in Ireland, failed in Iceland, failed everywhere they've been tried, and they're going to fail here. And the main way in which they fail is that the deficit increases, not decreases. And at that point, you lose your credit rating, and at that point, the government will be in really serious
trouble. Political economist Polly Winch was on last week. She was saying that actually what should be on the table in Europe and right around the Western world is a total debt write-down. Is that feasible?
It will happen as the banks collapse, because the austerity policy being pursued in the EU and in Britain, and probably if the Republicans have their way in the US, the austerity will become universal. That will actually crash the banking system, and that will wipe out the debts along with everybody's jobs, houses and pensions.
Okay, on to a big story today, which is the resignation of the Energy Secretary, Chris Huhne. I'd just like to get Alistair Watson, you're a Conservative councillor here in Bristol. What's your view on this? Because I'm a little bit concerned. He was a Lib Dem, very senior Lib Dem in the Cabinet. He was very much against nuclear power. This could mean something quite big for us here in Bristol if now Chris Huhne is out of the way, that policy switches towards a pro-nuclear power policy in the Energy Department. Rather than anti. And also, I wonder what you've got to say about the 2002 driving offence. I think most people in other parts of the world will be looking and saying, well, a driving offence? What on earth? This is not really... it's a speeding. Is it a speeding fine? It's not really a good reason to get rid of a senior politician.
That's not the offence. The offence is that he lied and he... Or he may, sorry.
Alleged.
Allegedly.
He denies it.
He denies it, of course. But, the driving offence is minor. No one will worry about that, but when you take the illegal task, or you do the illegal thing of trying to get your wife to take your points for you, and that's pretty serious. And I mean, I think most people within, you know, in the country would not do that. I wouldn't, you know, I don't have the morals and ethics that would say that I could get away with that, and if I could, I'd do it. I wouldn't do that.
Well, I did one of these driving courses recently because I'd done a speeding offence. Rather than take the points, you have to do a sort of sit there for an hour and listen.
Yeah,
and they were saying, actually, was it? No.
I had 4 hours when I had
it. I would say about 2 hours, something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they were saying that, oh, well, actually, only about 25% of the people that go up to their points limit actually get the licence taken away anyway. So maybe he should have taken the points if he did push them onto his wife, as is being alleged. Martin, what are your thoughts about Chris? Because this could actually massively affect national energy policy. We're looking at the potentially two nuclear power stations here. Do you think that that's an element in all
I
this?
Doubt it. I think the policy will be decided by, you know, Chris Huhne wasn't deciding the policy on his own. It'll be a coalition policy decided by the two parties in the coalition, and I suspect that there will be, you know, people pushing for the Hinkley to be upgraded and people pushing against from within the coalition.
It does sort of pale into insignificance amongst some of the allegations we were talking about over Christmas of David Cameron and his dilly-dallying with ex-South African nuclear weapons the early 90s.
I mean, but at the same time, I think the issue here, as Alice has pointed out, is not the fact that he was speeding, it's the fact that he's told fibs about it. And that means probably he has to give
allegedly
up his position.
Allegedly.
I mean, I think it's a resigning. I mean, it's a political thing as well. You resign politically because you're causing problems for your colleagues, and that's why you have to resign. It's not because it's particularly heinous crime or you've not eaten babies or anything, but you've just basically let the side down. It's like being sent off in a football game. He's just been sent off. But I don't think it'll change the policy. The policy will be a pretty controversial policy and will be argued through for and against. I don't think it'll make much difference.
Okay, another story this week. The student loan chief was let off tax while the rest of us have to pay. This was an expose by BBC's Newsnight programme. And it seems that the guy who's in charge of student loans is just using some kind of front company to pay himself, and he's not actually paying PIYA like everyone else should have to. Alistair, this doesn't really send a very good sign, does it, that the government is making sure that we're all in this together?
True, and someone's made a big error of judgment on this one. If you're head of any civil service department, or you're taking on, you know, even if this is only a fixed term contract of a year or two, he should still have been on a proper PAY system.
But isn't the surprising thing here actually that it's been exposed? I mean, one would expect that it's just sort of, it would have been gone along on the nod and the wink, and actually what's happening here is that right at senior levels here, we're talking about Danny Alexander and others in the senior levels of the government, are actually just trying to sort of do favours for their mates rather than run the country in a responsible and open manner.
Well, I don't know the whole background of this, and I don't know how he was taken on, what the employment conditions were, but obviously he's you know, using a service company, you know, and that's the sort of thing you would do if you were like me, going in as a management consultant, doing a few days here and there, and you know, you get the company would be paid. That's the way it should be done. But if you are actually an employee and you're full-time, or even if you're part-time but you have a long-term contract, then you should be paying National Insurance PAYE. I mean, I've got a 12-month contract at the moment with Science City Bristol, which I'm doing stuff for, and you know, I'm paid just as an employee, even though it's only a 12-month contract.
Martin, has Ed Lester been taking the mickey here, and Danny Alexander? And do you think there's going to be a more exposed of this because the government's
there may be others in the civil service who are sweating tonight because of this has been exposed. Because no doubt this might be a general practice rather than just a one-off. And of course, if others are in a similar position, they've got to, I mean, people in senior positions in the public and the private sector must realise in these times of austerity, eyes are going to be on them. They're not going to escape. If it looks like people aren't pulling their weight in terms of paying tax, people are going to get upset. And that'll be right across the political spectrum.
I mean, let's not get it wrong. I mean, he will be paying tax. It's just that there is a benefit in the national insurance side of things. So he'll be paying slightly less tax than would be the case if he was an employee. But I totally agree. I think that, you know, all civil servants, you know, all these sort of contracts should be, you know, properly taxed as every other employee has to be. And, you know, none of us like paying tax, but we do it. It's public duty.
Okay, probably our final story, I think, which is that Google starting to censor blogs. This is following Twitter's decision last month to begin censoring the messages of users based on restrictions of their respective countries. Google's followed suit, announced that it will begin a similar practice with its own blogging service. Alastair Watson, you're a Conservative local councillor here, Westbury-on-Trim. What are your thoughts about this one? Because up until now, you put up a blog and everyone can see it, apart from the Chinese, pretty much. Yes. Now it looks like they're going to be dividing up the internet into all these kind of national boundaries.
Yeah, I know. It seems like Google has sort of caved into national governments and said, okay, you know, we'll make sure you know where these blogs are from, and then you can censor them. I mean, it saddens me incredibly, and I suppose it's been done in a pragmatic way, because you know, if they don't, then it'll happen like the Chinese, where they'll just get shut down anyway, and the whole of the internet will.
But Google's a multi-squillion-pound business. Absolutely. You know, I'm sure it can afford to take a few lawsuits, can't it?
You would think so. And as I say, it saddens me that they've sort of caved into this one. They've allowed it to happen. I believe the internet should be free. People can say what they like. Yeah, I mean, you know, if they do libel other people, then they can be taken to court. But to actually try and censor things at source is very bad form. It's bad for liberty.
Well, I won't be surprised that I agree with that. I think one of the things I would say is that in this day and age, people will get round that anyway. I mean, if your government says you can't use Twitter, people will find some other way to communicate.
Well, they may as well advertise now. There's a company called WordPress that is not Blogger. So if you've got your blog on Google, you can cut and paste all your material from your blog and put it onto WordPress, who aren't doing this. And I think ultimately, isn't that the way these things work on the internet, Alistair?
Well, yes, absolutely. As far as I understand it, yes. And now WordPress is the big, you know, lots of people have their websites and blogs on WordPress. I'm sure that those people will transfer to that. It just seems that Google's selling out a bit here, I have to say. I'm saddened by the whole thing.
Martin, ultimately, Twitter, what about that? Because, you know, we're now seeing really what's effectively a way of saying to national governments around the world, well, we've had to do it for the Chinese and we're able to do that now for you, so that there will be a filtering, censoring process in different countries.
Well, but Twitter have got a brand to think of. If Twitter becomes associated with that kind of kowtowing to powerful people, that will be reflected in people's attitudes towards Twitter, won't it?
And what will that mean?
Well, it means people will find other ways. They'll go to WordPress or whatever. I mean, frankly, I find Twitter... I know all politicians... Are you on Twitter, Alistair?
Of course I'm on Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, so you've got several times a day where you can put your foot in it if you're not careful.
Yeah, I haven't done any tweets during this programme, I have to say.
Alistair, what do you normally tweet about? What sort of things?
Well, actually to be truthful, I'm not tweeting politically. I tweet through my job as a network director at Science City Bristol, and we do. We got a Twitter account there, so it's more about what business is doing, what technology companies are saying at the moment, that sort of stuff.
And is it something that you think actually these kinds of technologies are absolutely essential now, or is it something that's you can sort of take it or leave it?
It's absolutely essential, and it's the way you know that we're moving away from websites now. In the heart of most new companies, particularly in the technology field, is the social networking. Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, they are the drivers. You have your website as somewhere to put stuff, which is generally very static. The rest of it's a dynamic thing. So, yeah, it's moving on now, yeah.
Finally, I've just got to talk about this just very briefly. BMW are red-faced after sponsoring a deadly Cooper cold front. This has been the practice in Germany for a long time. This cold front that's gone across the whole of Europe is sponsored by BMW, who, incidentally, basically are... if you watched a documentary in Germany called The Silence of the Quants, was financed entirely with Nazi money, BMW was, and it's a private company. Anyway, that's time to... for the Sky News at 6 now, thanks to this week's guest, Conservative spokesman for Sport and Leisure, councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Alistair Watson. After the news, drug policy and Friends of the Earth.
BCFM.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News.